the actual ceremonial is always regarded as a social contract in which two people are going to come together to make the very best attempt at training themselves in order to help each other that they possibly can. And so you get, unfortunately, I haven't got the whole of the wedding ceremony here, but I think, I should have brought the other book. I take my refuge in the Buddha, that I may realize the true way and the highest mind. I wish to help all living things. These are the vows taken at a wedding ceremony. I take my refuge in the Dharma. I wish to help all living things in order to enter the store of the scriptures, so that I may make the wisdom of this my family as wide as the ocean. I take my refuge in the Sangha. I wish to help all living things so that they and my family shall possess an immaculate and peaceful heart. In other words, they are going to make each other a success, each in their own way, to the very best of their ability. There is not going to be any one that is the superior and another the inferior. They are each going to make themselves a success, each in their own way. Now, every Buddhist country has a slightly different thing after this, which is their particular social way of taking vows. I have quite simply adopted the Western way of doing this and put that in there. In some countries in the East, the vows are they promise to cherish and love each other, and then he promises to provide her with a place to live, to guard the children, money to keep the family, and adornment, which is very interesting. That's the vows in the Chinese section. And the female, wife, promises to love and cherish, to guard the things that he brings, to look after the children so that they shall be good Buddhists, and, interestingly enough, to cook. She actually promises to cook during the wedding ceremony. And he promises adornment. And those two are the last two, and one sort of can't help wondering if they don't weigh one with the other, but I could be wrong on that one. Anyway, each country has a slightly different piece just here. But the whole point of the thing is to make each other a success, each in their own way. There is no attempt for the man to be the woman or the woman to be the man. There is an attempt for the man to make the woman a success and for the woman to make the man a success. And that is what they are really promising to do. And if you think about it, that makes a lot more sense than any of the other things that sometimes are required. And in the actual marriage contract that follows, you have this. We are now being given the light of the Lord, which is full of grace, so that we have been able to marry each other. From this time, we are going to be converted deeply to the three treasures of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and make both our bodies and our minds pure, so that we may make no mistakes in human morals. We are going to help each other and make each of us a success in our own way. We offer the merit of all we do for the welfare of all mankind. I find that personally one of the most beautiful marriage contracts in existence. It's not an attempt to order anybody about or to try and be boss or to try and be submissive. It's simply an attempt to be two human beings trying to be a first-rate success and loving each other enough to want the other to be a success, which automatically gives us all four wisdoms right there. Charity, benevolence, tenderness, and sympathy. And what more can a marriage need? That's really what a marriage needs in Buddhism. There is the lighting of the marriage candle. They each come in carrying a candle, two separate beings, now becoming one. And they light the marriage candle, and the two separate ones are blown out. So there is the wedding ceremony. It is a contract, a social contract, which doesn't make it any less of a truly religious ceremony. There is one difference in it, in the minds of the East at any rate, from that of the West. And that is, divorce is not possible. Of course, it happens over here with Buddhists. But in the East, divorce is not possible. Once you've married, he says, I do, she says, I do, and the priest says, you bet you do. And that's the end of it. Over here, we have other ways of going about it, but the East does not. So, it is incumbent, however, upon the children to look after their parents, to provide them with a place in their old age, which is one of the reasons why we're planning an elderly people's place to live up in Shasta for the monks' parents. They're all getting to that age now. It is that duty, and it is also the duty of the parents to go to the monastery after they have brought up and educated their children to carry on there as they would have done if they had been younger as monks. So it is quite normal for the monastery to be the old person's home, and it is the reason why in Buddhist countries, at least until Western modernization got to them, they didn't have a problem with the elderly. The monasteries took them on, or the children took them on automatically. That was part of the teachings of the Buddha, to honor the parents. And in Thailand and Burma and all over the place, I'm not sure about Burma because I hear it's now thinking of having a revolution of some sort with regard to religion, but I do know with Thailand still, it is normal, as soon as the children have grown up and finished their schooling, the parents say, right, our duty is now done in the world. Now I can go off and find the eternal. And they wear white in the monastery instead of yellow robes because they are lay members of the Sangha, laymen and laywomen. And there they study the same as the monks. And they do a lot of work to help the monks and help around the monastery, bring in their know-how, helping to build things, doing accounts. All the things they've learned in the world, they can now give gladly and happily and train with it at the same time and not be made to feel, as old people are so often nowadays, just a charge to the state or a nuisance to their children. I personally find it a very beautiful way to go. So, what am I doing? The next one, I thought you were looking at me. The next one is the funeral ceremony. Now, funerals are an ordination ceremony. Since you were not ordained as a priest in life, and you may not have found the eternal, let's at least be ordained as a priest in death. And then if you do come back as a result of rebirth, that part of you will seek the eternal all the more avidly. And if you go to that place where, because you just haven't had time, you may go to where Amida Buddha, that aspect of the Buddha is, and you'll already be a monk, all rearing and ready to go. And so it promises you, as usual, as is usual with Buddhism, it promises you the most in death, as well as the most in life. And that one thing, which, if you like, is a greed-based thing, is still nevertheless extraordinarily valuable in pushing people towards doing actual training of themselves. For the funeral ceremony is quite literally, as I said, an ordination ceremony. It is almost identical to the ordination ceremony of a monk. And a monk wears white under his robes, because that is the color of his shroud. So he is wearing his shroud. He is a dead man as far as the world is concerned. So he appears as a monk. And when the dead are prepared for burial in the East, they are normally washed very carefully, and their heads are shaved, and they are dressed in a white robe, holding a rosary, and they are placed in the kneeling position with their hands together, with their hands bound with the rosary, and they are bent over. I can't really do this, and I can't really get down on the floor. Yeah, it's a full bowing position, holding the rosary up like this, if you can do it. Yeah, that's right. That is how a person is buried, bowing to the eternal. Yes, that is the way it is done, with a shaven head and white robe and your rosary. And a rectual wagesa. A wagesa is what laymen wear. It's just a piece of material that goes around here. And also the kechi miyaku. Now, you remember I told you got a sort of family tree or bloodline at the time of doing the big Jukai procession, of following, going wherever one follows. This is spread out, this family tree or bloodline, placed on the shoulder as the monastic robe, showing your bloodline down like this. And this raksu or bagesa is placed over the top. And thus you are buried. And usually a piece of paper with the three refuges. I take refuge in the Buddha, I take refuge in the Dharma, I take refuge in the Sangha, is placed between the lips. And so the person is buried. Very simply. There is no embalming, absolutely no embalming. Buddhists go up the pole if somebody suggests embalming the dead. It is the one thing you do not do. They are normally buried in a basket, or rather not buried, burned. They are placed in a wicker basket, which the family makes for themselves. In this position, the basket is then covered with a beautiful golden monk's robe that is borrowed from the temple, which is placed over the top of it. And the person is very solemnly and very beautifully ordained. The robe is then removed, the basket taken to a place that, if you can imagine an oriental roof on four poles, four pillars, just a roof on four pillars, underneath which there are two holes slightly bigger than the basket. The family brings two bags of charcoal, places one on the bottom, sets light to it, places the body on top, places the other bag of charcoal over it, sets light to that, and then puts a piece of matting over the top. And the family does this themselves. And the whole cost of that is probably about $10, if at most, including all the fees to the government officials. The most expensive thing is the priest, is the monk. And he costs about $5. If you think about that and the costs of funerals over here, it's quite startling. And it's very pure and it's very beautiful. And because the people do it for themselves, they have a much greater understanding of death, of life and death. There is not the fear, not the running away from it. Not the trying to make it not appear what it really is. The attempts at makeup, which crack, and as we know, over here. There is none of the embalming, none of the attempt to make the person not seem dead. Death is accepted. It happens. This is the way it is. Now, sometimes people are buried instead of burned, in which case they will use a box or a coffin, or sometimes just still keep the basket. Either way, one does not change the procedure. Now, if the person is actually buried, then the relatives, after the coffin has been placed in the ground, are asked to help to fill the grave. It is important that they either light the pyre or fill the grave. They have to know it has happened. And it is so much more beautiful to tenderly drop some earth on your loved one than to hear some professional gardener shoveling without feeling. I have done so many funerals, and I have heard that. In the old days when I was a musician, I used to play for these things, and I would hear the grave diggers afterwards just singing and throwing the dirt on the coffin. It was not only disrespectful, it was scary. There was no understanding and no respect, and the person was just singing to stop himself being scared as the afternoon got darker and he was filling the hole. I knew quite well what was going on. And this way, there is the gentleness, the love, and the acceptance. And this is one of the big reasons that I am a Buddhist. There is this understanding of things, not the running away from them. Yes, go ahead.
One thing that I noticed about it, in the funerals you've had a chance, is when the family actually takes the spade and puts dirt on the coffin, there's a very crucial moment.
Very.
It's a moment where the family actually buries their dead. We use that phrase, you have to bury your dead. And it's really very true for people to make the actual acceptance of death complete,
yes,
and to send their loved ones on their way. They have to bury them one way or another, and that's the best way to
And be
them.
Willing to, and know that that's what they're doing, and not have things pulled down like smoke screens in front of them so that they don't know that that's what they're doing. Yes, go ahead.
I heard about a woman dying and her dog, this is America, but the dog for weeks kept waiting to find her when the door opened for her. And I suspect it was due to the dissociation.
Yes, it is.
I wonder if you can actually educate a pet.
I think so. I know that you can educate children because I know what happened to me. My grandfather died when I was about 6, one of my grandfathers, and I badly wanted to see him, and my mother was terrified of the idea. And the uncle in whose house he died said, "Let her see him. It's terribly important she sees him." And he took me by the hand out and took me upstairs to see him, where he was lying in state, so to speak. And he said, "Now touch him." He said, "You're going to find him cold. He's going to feel different from what he used to. But touch him." And I did. He said, "You can kiss him if you want to." And I've never been scared of a dead body since. It's very important that we don't hide our children from these things. They have to know what goes on in the world. And they have to know it's not frightening. It's a very beautiful thing in the end to see a dead body. There's great peace there, great acceptance, great beauty, and tremendous humility. No wonder they thought that the best place to learn meditation was to meditate on dead bodies. They put in a practical note, "Do it downwind," which in the East was probably very good sense. But it is important to know and accept and recognize and not be afraid. And that's... excuse me. That's really when you know that birth and death are just simply two points in time. You can really know it for certain then. And this is true too whether you are burning, cremating, or burying. You have to be willing to fully accept and see. Now, during the funeral ceremony, a priest will answer the willingness of the dead to keep the precepts. If there is a relative that is a priest, or a layman who is a very devout layman, as we call them, a lay minister, he can do the job of stand-in for the dead. And he will kneel on the altar beside the coffin. And as the priest says, "Will you keep this precept or not?" he will answer,
I will.
Or for so-and-so, I will. And so the whole of the ceremony is gone through with someone acting as proxy in this way. I don't need to go through it any more than this because it's fairly clear what happens from what I have said. It is an ordination ceremony. You are becoming a monk. Yes, yes, yes. There are what are called the exhortations. There's the exhortation at the time of death, the one at the time of the closing of the coffin, and the one at the third day and the seventh and all the rest of them. And you can actually feel, it's very interesting, you can actually feel and know when you can stop giving them. You can really know that. Yes. There are, of course, memorial ceremonies, which are simply ceremonies in which you recite scriptures and place, offerings on the altar, in which you are saying, we do not know where you are. You may have been reborn. We don't know exactly what happens after death. We have theories, but we don't know. So if you were reborn in a heaven or a hell or in the human state, wherever you are, we want the benefit of what we have given to you, because we have given this as a present to the priest, for them to give the merit to you. That is the meaning of memorial ceremony. And it helps people to come together and gradually get over the mourning period. It was believed in the East that the period of mourning took 3 years, and that it also took 3 years for a person to be completely finished with dealing with whatever they had got up to in this world. This is, as I said, doctrine. Since I am not at the moment dead, I have no way of telling you if this is actually what happened. I believe that some of it is very probably true, but I won't know for a little, I hope. So, this is the purpose of memorial ceremonies, and in any case, it is giving dana, it is being benevolent, it is showing the rest of the signs of enlightenment. That being so, it cannot do harm. It can only do good. Now, the last one is Sigaki. There is very little in this book about Sigaki, because very little has ever been written about it. The time of Sigaki in the East is called Obon, the festival of lanterns. The Buddha himself recommended that Sigaki be used, as he did the funeral and memorial. Sigaki came about as the result of one of his chief disciples, Ananda, having a terrible dream about his dead mother, whom he saw suffering in hell, unable to drink and unable to eat. She was, in fact, a hungry ghost, one of these, like the cannibals with the thin neck and the big tummy. And he didn't know what to do. He felt really bad after this particular nightmare. And he went to the Buddha and said, what can I do? How can I help? Obviously, she is suffering great torment, and there must be thousands of others like her. What can we do? And the Buddha said, light lanterns, make a great feast, make sure the food is very pure and holy in the way in which you prepare it. Make sure that it is the sort of food that you could give to monks. And then we will put it all on the altar, and we will make much ceremonial, and we will invite all these hungry ghosts to come and eat. And this is exactly what happened. And the next night, Ananda had a dream again. And there was his mother sitting at the table with the cosmic Buddha and all the other historical Buddhas and all the saints, and she was able to laugh and to eat and to drink because it had been offered with a pure heart. And this is a memorial ceremony called Sigaki that has come down to this day and is still used, as I said, at the Festival of Lanterns. Now, you have the Obon Festival here in San Francisco, but you have it in August. In Japan, everybody takes 3 days off. And they've got into the habit of sending up fireworks as well, just so that their particular dead know where to come down. Since everybody's sending up fireworks, that somewhat defeats the purpose, but that's all right, too. And they have the fire department is the only one that does not get off on Obon because they've got to make sure half the town doesn't get burned down. As it is, there are a tremendous number of Obon fires, and the fire departments of Japan dread Obon, and also the industry of the country, to such an extent that they've made it on two separate months. The country north of from Tokyo upwards has to do it in July, and the country south of Japan, south of Tokyo, all has to do it in August. Thus, half the country is functioning, while the other half is enjoying its greatest religious festival. If you think about it carefully, the time for doing this in this country is the old time of Michaelmas, Halloween. And that's precisely when we do it here, or when we do it up in Shasta. And it seems to work out much better. It's the right time for this climate and our type of thinking. This is our tradition, in other words. And so we hold the ceremony then. There are some delightful pictures of Sigakis. There is one that I would love to have a copy of, which is in Germany. Now, there are only very, very few of copies in existence, though. And it shows a huge Chinese altar. And there are three priests standing there doing the ceremony, looking so pleased with themselves. And on the altar lies out one ghost who got religion, and the fire's coming out of his ears, and he's stuffing his mouth full, and he's so happy he's sitting there on the altar, he got religion. And there are others sneaking away underneath, running off the little bits, and you see one lugging a great melon, and so it goes on. It's one of the most delightful pictures I have ever seen. But, of course, it scares the living daylights out of a lot of people. I mean, there's this bunch of ghosts lying on the altar. What is going on? Ghost worship? No. If you understand the teachings of Buddhism, you see that this is one of the most beautifully delightful pictures in existence. Now, Sigaki normally takes an entire day. Early in the morning, just before dawn, the priest should go to the cemetery and invite all the ghosts and the dead and anybody who wants to turn up to come to the great feast. And he lights candles. It's the reason why we have those little sort of candle, we've got, what do they call those things? Stalagmites? Stalactites we found a lot on the property. And we built them as roofs with four little posts and put a lamp underneath each. And they are all the way up the path to the altar in the cemetery. And we light these because it's very early, and the ghosts need to see their way. This is the old belief. And they must stay alight until midnight. They have 12 hours to come and eat. And you make this huge meal on the altar. And the priest offers them to come and eat. And there was an argument over here. What would be the great staple that everybody would love? Because over in the East, there is nothing like solid beaten rice. And the average Westerner can't stand solid beaten rice. I mean, it kills 4 or 5 people each year in Tokyo alone just from strangulation on trying to eat it. So we decided on coffee and donuts. After all, what else would an American eat other than coffee and donuts? So that's what we've settled for, not sweet tea and rice balls, but coffee and donuts. And this happens in every Buddhist country. They choose the food that is most popular to the population. You're not copying the East. You are trying to make Buddhism work in your own country. And that's a very different matter. And we hold the ceremony. The rest of the day is a festival for everyone. And then just after midnight, the priest goes up and says it is time and returns everyone and the lights are put out. This is a very comforting festival. If a person commits suicide, it is always performed together with, immediately, or that is, in immediately after the funeral ceremony, in order to help the person who was so obviously worried and miserable that they couldn't hear the teaching. Obviously, there must be a hungry ghost in there somewhere, and whether there is or not, let's do the ceremony so as to help them as much as possible. There is no turning away from a person who has committed suicide. There is only how can we help. Right. No, in actual fact, they don't. There are one or two things for a mother and a dead child, for example, a mother whose child dies in childbirth. There is a special ceremony for that. There's a ceremony for both a dead mother and a dead child dying in childbirth. There's one for mentally defective people and one for mad people, which are all very, very beautiful again. Because madness has always been regarded as the result of picking up some really atrocious karma and having been had the courage and the misery of putting up with this, then it is decided in Buddhism that the person goes straight to Buddha. They don't have to be ordained and do any more training. They did such a great work in cleaning up this incredible lump of karma left behind. They are immediately to Buddhahood. It's a very, very beautiful and positive ceremony. Quite a different type of mind from what people get into sometimes. Yeah. Very beautiful indeed. And they have a little piece of ceremonial in there whereby a string is tied to the hand of the dead mad person. And someone cuts it, symbolizing that they are cut forever from madness. And now go straight to Buddha. Yeah. The rosary, to count breaths if you're trying to learn to concentrate in meditation. To count the number of recitations of the name of the Buddhas. Quite literally that. Some people use it just to find out how long they've been sitting, which is not the best of ideas. The Buddhists were 500 years older than the Catholics, so, yeah, it's been around a long time.